The Outspoken Cyclist podcast is supported by the Dodd Camera Company. An Ohio institution in photography for over 100 years, Dodd Camera has stayed right in step with the newest in digital cameras and accessories, as well as offering services such as photo restoration and large format printing. Dodd Camera stores are located in Cleveland, Dayton, Cincinnati, Chicago, and now Columbus in the Oak Creek Shopping Center on Cameron Avenue. If you don't have one in your town, you can find them online at doddcamera.com. At Dodd Camera, the focus is on you.
Time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks, and this is our show for November 18th, 2017. Next week is Thanksgiving, and that means we're only a few weeks away from Christmas, and perhaps you're still thinking, I have plenty of time, right? Yeah, I guess you do. But in an effort to move you in a direction, any direction, toward fulfilling your goals of holiday shopping, we'll have our annual chat with Gloria Liu for Bicycling Magazine. Gloria and I are going to talk about several items that have come across her radar in a variety of categories, including apparel, the gravel market, kids looking for gifts under the tree, and what might fit into your stocking. We'll also speak with Nick Legan, author of the new gravel cycling book from Velo Press. Nick was a pro team mechanic for 7 years. He's been the tech editor for Velo News and reviews products for adventure cycling. His love of the gravel events, especially the Dirty Kanza, is detailed in his new book, Gravel Cycling, The Complete Guide to Gravel Racing and Adventure Bikepacking. Nick explains the difference between gravel racing and cyclocross, as well as how easy it is to just roll out the door and into a gravel adventure. First up, though, is Jim Sonhalter. Jim works for Cuyahoga County Planning here in Northeast Ohio. Recently, the suburb of Euclid, Ohio, which is right on the lakefront, was highlighted in an article by Cleveland Plain Dealer reporter Stephen Litt. The article was titled, Euclid Close to Building Lakefront Trail That Could Set a Precedent in the Great Lakes. In it, Litt details the plan that the suburb has to develop the lakefront. But more importantly, Jim will fill us in on the county's master plan and how Euclid's piece fits into it. So I'm pleased to be able to welcome Jim Sonhalter into the studio here at WJCU. Hi, Jim. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for coming into the studio to join me today.
Thanks, Diane, for the invitation.
Well, I haven't seen you in a while. How have you been?
Pretty good.
Yeah.
Kind of busy.
I guess you have. Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about you and your background and the work that you do?
Well, first and foremost, I'm an urban planner, and I work for the Cuyahoga County Planning Commission, or county planning as we call ourselves. And I manage the Planning Services Division, and we're basically public sector-based planning consultants.
Explain what that means.
Well, there are a lot of planning consultants out in the world working in the private sector. We happen to be in government. We're an independent agency, but we do subsidize master plan updates. We have a program for that, but we also work under contract to various communities.
Ah, like the one I live in.
Yes.
Right. We had that conversation before we got started here this morning. So November 12th, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, a reporter, Stephen Litt, who I always thought of as the architecture guy, is obviously into some other stuff, wrote a piece about the Euclid, Ohio Lakefront Project. What do you know about the history of the project and the scope of it?
Oh, it's very exciting. You know, I'm a Euclid resident for the last 20 years, and people say everyone's been talking about a marina for the last 40 or 50 years.
Oh, a marina.
A marina, any kind of waterfront development.
Well, which I think our waterfront is so underutilized. Unless you're a Browns fan, which I'm not. Anyway, so what's happening with this project?
Well, officially it's the Waterfront Improvement Plan, and it is a plan to build an all-purpose trail, a multi-purpose trail that connects Sims Park, 30 acres right on the water with Hen Mansion right in downtown Euclid, to a point about three-quarters of a mile to the east to another property that the city owns around East 250th Street.
And so what's going on with that three-quarters of a mile now?
Historically, that part of the lakefront, as with most of the lakefront, it's been privately held by various beach clubs and private property owners. So the city and the beach clubs came together and developed a memorandum of understanding to have an easement across that, to allow public access across privately held property, which is absolutely great and unprecedented in Euclid.
Is there any pushback from residents? Are you getting cooperation?
Cooperation, but it took a lot of negotiation, too. It's just a conversation that people 10, 20 years ago just probably could not have imagined.
Yeah, I know some people who live along that Euclid lakefront, and it's so beautiful. I mean, you could just walk out your front or backyard, whichever way your house faces, and right to the lake, which is really cool. So this is going to be a paved path?
Yes, paved path, and the goal is to restore the beach. What they're calling a cobbled beach. It's not going to be a white sandy beach or anything like that, but really a beach that can support natural habitat, which is just fantastic.
So how will this eventually hook up with going west?
Going west, right now it terminates at Sims Park, but there's also another park just north of East 222nd Street. So, eventually there are ways that you can wind along the lakefront through that park and eventually get over to Edgecliff Drive and back out to Lakeshore Boulevard. But that path's a little more circuitous.
And that does not run right along the lakefront. So Lakeshore Boulevard's a little bit south of the lakefront.
It is. It is.
So along with this plan, this big plan for Euclid, because it seems to be a big deal, what will be happening in terms of the full master plan, because I know you've worked on that, for the county?
A really interesting piece of this in planning for the lakefront while I was with the city of Euclid was that we worked with our consultants to ensure that we're creating lakefront access for everybody. So we came up with a conceptual trail plan that looked at alignments along public rights of way so that you could really get to the lakefront from any neighborhood in the city, which was great because historically, if you live north of the boulevard, that's how you were able to get to the lake. But now we're looking at maybe cycle tracks, maybe all-purpose trails in the public right-of-way, so that from south of the boulevard, south of the freeway, anywhere in the city, you could take a nice walk, grab your bike, and get to the lake.
Which would be really, really nice. Will this ever become part of a network that goes all the way along the lake, all the way to downtown Cleveland?
Absolutely. The city's looking at options for Lakeshore Boulevard and for Euclid Avenue to install cycle tracks. Right now there are sharrows, which is a great place to start.
Right.
It's more of a reminder to drivers that, hey, cyclists belong there.
When they look.
When they look.
Right.
And there are signs reminding drivers of that as well. But I would love to see a separated cycle track all the way down Lakeshore Boulevard. Now, once you cross 185th Street to the west, bike lanes start right at the City of Cleveland border and take you all the way to Brattonall.
So you actually work for the county, not for and you work – it's a separate organization?
County planning is an independent agency.
Okay.
We're not a county department per se.
Okay.
So we have our own board and our own mission.
What is your goal in terms of what you'd like to see besides just cycle tracks?
Our goal here with this plan is really to promote connectivity throughout the county. As I said before, in developing a comprehensive trail network in the city of Euclid – we then jumped into the East Side Greenway, which was Euclid plus 19 other communities and a number of public agencies, including the Metro Parks, to say, how can we create in this, eastern part of the county, a very densely built-up part of the county, bike trails, enhanced pedestrian facilities to connect these communities to each other, to get them to the Metro Parks, to get them to the lakefront and any other point, to Lake County to Lorain County. Right. It's all just part of a bigger network. And it was very well received. And another interesting part of that was we're really putting into the public mindset the idea of active transportation and benefits for public health.
Okay, I want to talk about that. Okay. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Jim Sonhalter. He's with the County Planning. I guess that's what it is, County Planning.
County Planning.
Commission? Are you a commission?
We are a commission, but, you know, we kind of shortened it.
Who commissioned you? No, just kidding.
We're rebranding ourselves. We're County Planning.
County Planning, which is really important. People may not understand how Cleveland works. So Cleveland is sort of the central area at, I don't know how you would define it in terms of east-west. I guess the west would be the Cuyahoga River pretty much, although it even goes beyond that. But all of these suburbs have their own mayors and fire departments and EMS, and it's just obnoxious, really, that we aren't all part of this one big thing. So you have to really kind of, you know, like work together to make something happen on a sort of network basis.
We keep in mind that we have in Cuyahoga County, we have 59 sets of nearly everything.
Which redundancy upon redundancy from the Department of Redundant Redundancy. That's really sad. I don't know if that – I guess it was all had to do originally with water here, right? Isn't that the way I understood it?
With water and sewer, there's a regional approach. But there are a lot of government – you know, local governments are coming together and embracing regionalism, and it's really – starting with safety services, police and fire, you know, consolidated regional dispatch centers around the county. So it's not new. It's just we're trying to create a more regional approach with active transportation now.
Yeah, so that's what I want to talk about, active transportation. So, you know, the idea, young people, and in fact, as I remember, you and Kath only have one car.
That's right. We downsized.
And have almost always used bicycles for all kinds of stuff. I can remember when your kids were little, Kath telling me that, you know, she took them everywhere in a cargo bike, more or less.
Our second car was a Burley trailer.
Exactly. My second car is a Burley trailer, which would make a nice bumper sticker. I wonder if Burley's listening. But I just think that the idea that Cleveland and the metropolitan area could become more alternate transportation friendly is a really good idea after being here all these years.
It's a great idea.
So what do you think would be next? If once this Euclid project is done, what else are you working on?
Well, we talked about Euclid. I talked about the East Side Greenway, which was received so well. We applied for funding and now we're doing a county greenway plan.
Oh, that's kind of cool. So define the East Side Greenway and then tell me what your idea is for this county plan.
Well, the East Side Greenway was looking at ways to create a very well-connected active transportation network that, say, if you want to go from Euclid to Shaker or from Shaker to Moreland Hills, is there a safe and easy way to do that? Now, as I said, it's a pretty developed end of the county, so we were really looking hard at public rights of way. And, you know, some streets have big grassy medians down the center. Is that a great place for a trail? Or is the right-of-way wide enough that we can put a trail to the side? Or is it constrained enough that, well, maybe the best we can do are bike lanes? So we came up with projects that are transformational that would completely change the way, say, Warrensville Center Road works.
That would be awesome.
Do we need all those lanes along the entire length? Can we repurpose that street to accommodate?
Well, you know who Chuck Marone is with Strong Town. So his concept is you narrow streets to slow traffic to help businesses, number one. You know, they just built Oakwood Commons on Warrensville Center in our area. And it's just, you know, it's just this massive – there's a Walmart and a TJ Maxx and a Burlington Coat. And now they're building some big kosher market, which is okay. But now you've got like six lanes across. I just don't understand why that has to be that way.
Yeah. And, you know, this – we keep coming back to terms describing health. So what you're talking about is a road diet. You know, can we shed a little weight by reducing lanes? And that's a concept that is, you know, it's gaining some traction. But, you know, you can imagine the resistance you get from drivers when you present that to them.
Yeah. So we have a whole new generation of younger people coming up who may not be driving a car, and that may help to start to change things. Well, what's your next big project? Wait, let me back up and ask you, when will you know that this Euclid project, or is it going forward already? I know you've done a lot of studies and stuff.
It's my understanding that construction begins this summer.
Oh, that's really cool. That's really cool. So then a completion date would be a year, 2 years?
Yeah, let's say that, sure.
It's three quarters of a mile. How, never mind. We're talking Northeast Ohio and winter and on the lakefront, right? We have that issue. What's next for you guys in terms of alternative transportation after this Greenway project? And I'll be interested to see how you decide to go through Shaker and Moreland Hills and some of these other kind of tony neighborhoods that may give you some pushback with this stuff.
Well, we aim to be complete with the Greenway plan June 2018.
Wow, that's coming up.
We do have some public meetings coming up January 17th and 18th at various locations, and I'll be sure to send those to you so you can broadcast those.
Okay, do you already have locations, or is there someplace people can go to look at that stuff?
Sure. There's a website. Just if you Google County Greenway or Cuyahoga County Greenway, you'll get right to it.
Oh, okay.
And that's if you want to do a little homework, the Eastside Greenway also has its own website, which is eastsidegreenway.weebly.com.
Weebly?
Weebly.
Weebly's kind of a cute little word, Weebly. Well, this has been very interesting. We don't always do a lot of local stuff, but I think that it looks to broaden people's ideas about what's going on in Northeast Ohio and what can be done elsewhere. So the Euclid Project, if they want to just look at how the Euclid project is going, where would they go to just look at Euclid?
Cityofeuclid.com.
Oh, simple, simple, simple.
They post updates on various projects, if it's a simple road project or any other project the city has going on.
So if you were to characterize Cleveland in terms of what you know around the country for alternative transportation, and I imagine you attend different different symposia and that kind of thing, where would you put Cleveland in terms of, or Northeast Ohio in terms of how far along we are? I stumped the stars.
I think great things are happening through Bike Cleveland and its chapters, Bike Euclid, Bike Lakewood, Bike Brecksville. I understand that Bike Medina is slowly gathering steam. And, you know, it's all about getting the message out there, because cyclists are very enthusiastic. I think they need to talk to more people than just cyclists. We need to get the message out there that – and you made a point earlier of the younger generation not having as many cars. Well, we're all getting older, and maybe we don't need to drive or want to drive as much either. So I think we're all looking for communities that are just – walkable and bikeable and safe and easy to get around.
So there's one more thing that just occurred to me that you may or may not know about. What about public transit?
I use it quite a bit.
Well, I know you do, and it exists. But for example, the Rapid, which is our little train system, you know, it kind of stops in the middle of Shaker. It kind of stops at the airport. What's going to happen in terms of expansion of train travel? Do you have any ideas? Is anything happening?
I was part of a steering committee that looked at extending the Red Line and Health Line. And it comes down to bus rapid transit being maybe the most feasible choice. Rail is just really, really expensive. You know, when looking at the rail option and extending it out to the Euclid Square Mall site, you know, taking it as far as, well, it looked at going that far in the 80s, as I understand.
Okay.
So we're talking billions of dollars of investment in transit. But if you compare that to the cost of adding lanes on freeways, building new interchanges, is it really that unattainable?
Yeah. See, to me, it's not. It seems to me that corridor down 71 right in the middle would have been a great place for a train between Cleveland and Columbus and Cincinnati. But no, that wasn't happening either. I'm just wondering. I think those things are going to happen eventually. They're going to have to happen.
I think so.
You know, yeah. You have self-driving cars now. You have all kinds of stuff. But hopefully we can get rid of some of that. Well, Jim, thank you for coming in, taking time from your office day today and be out and about and come into the studio and talk about the Euclid Project. Jim Sunhalter from County Planning. And again, it's
cityofeuclid.com.
Cityofeuclid.com. All right. And we'll talk to you again. Say hi to Kath.
Will do.
All righty.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Jim Sonhalter from Cuyahoga Planning joined me right here in the PDX studio at WJCU. I think we're about to do something right here in Northeast Ohio. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll chat with Bicycling Magazine's Gloria Liu about some of the hot gifts for 2017. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. Well, we're back, and as promised, it's off to Emmaus, Pennsylvania to talk with Bicycling Magazine's Gloria Liu. Hello, Gloria. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for coming back to the show. It's hard to believe it's time for holiday again.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's nice to be back.
Really? So as editor for Bicycling, you get to see all the new stuff lots of times before other people do, and with Christmas less than 6 weeks away, I think it'd be nice to talk now and not have people wait till the very last second.
Yeah, that's always a better approach for getting a good gift for someone.
It is. So what's new in apparel? What do you got?
Well, I always think that the best kind of gift is the thing that somebody reaches for over and over again. For me, that's either probably my packable wind vest or packable wind jacket. I think those are just two essential items that every cyclist should own if you plan on riding in anything but, you know, perfect weather. One item I've been recommending everywhere is the Pearl Izumi Elite Barrier Convertible Jacket. So it's actually a wind vest and wind jacket in one. The sleeves zip off from the jacket, so it becomes a vest. So you never have to choose between the two. And it's also just like a really nice breathable fabric, so you don't overheat in it. When you're, you know, riding, and if you're mountain biking, that's sort of always my litmus test for breathability, is whether a piece can keep me from, you know, overheating and just getting super sweaty and clammy right away. And this one definitely passes that test. So, yeah, that's probably the one piece I'd recommend in terms of a good gift in terms of apparel.
How about color? Does it come in more than one color?
Yeah, it actually comes in a ton of colors. I don't have the exact number off the top of my head. It's at least 10. And there's some high visibility colorways, which is always great if you want to make sure that your loved one is seen on the road, or there's some stuff that's more subtle too for people who have a little bit more of a low-key sense of style. So, yeah, lots of different options, and men's and women's versions as well.
Nice.
So, yeah.
Nice.
So, you know, if you have a cyclist in your life, there's probably a color and a size and
right.
version to fit them. So.
Right. Well, as I remember, the barrier stuff from Pearl is pretty breathable, even though it's not completely waterproof.
Yeah, it is water resistant. So I've ridden in like light showers, and when there's that just kind of like dampness in the air, you know, and it's definitely done a great job of protecting me from moisture then. But yeah, that's, you know, with water resistance and breathability, those two usually, you know, are a little bit mutually, they're always at odds with each other. But this is one of those pieces that offers, I would say probably leans on the breathability side, but offers a decent amount of water resistance too, so you can encounter some unforeseen weather without, you know, getting wet. So.
Okay. Well, you know, gravel's the big category these days. What do you have that might appeal to the gravel rider or racer or the bike packing cyclist?
Yeah. So it may sound kind of funny, but I think that one of the items people are getting kind of excited about these days is handlebar bags.
Yay.
So
I like that.
Yeah. They're fun and they're cute. And, you know, when you're going out on this kind of adventure style ride, you tend to bring a lot more. You bring an extra set of tubes, tools, more snacks, that kind of thing. And it's nice not to have to just stuff all of it into your pockets. So a lot of people are, you know, adding handlebar bags to their bikes. One model that's been pretty popular around the bicycling office is Street, which is a little company out of Portland. And what's cool about their bags is that a lot of them have this strap system so that the bag can either convert to a handlebar bag or a hip pack, and or just like a regular side bag with, you know, shoulder straps. So that's pretty cool. It makes it more versatile. Like if you don't want something rattling around on your handlebar, you can, you know, convert the bag to a hip pack. And in either situation, it's very secure and stable. And they come in two different sizes, as well as a bunch of really fun colors and designs. Like they have like a camo design, and they have all these kind of fun fluorescent colors, but also stuff that's more, you know, neutral too. So a lot of options there as well.
So North Streets out of Portland, are they made in Portland?
I believe they are, but I'd have cool. to actually double check on that. Yeah.
Cool. Great. Yeah. All right. Now I know that neither of us are little kids, but little kids and bikes go together. What's happening in the youth market right now? Do you know of anything that, you know, kids are looking at?
Well, there's definitely a lot of kids' bikes out there that I feel like, you know, it's funny with kids' bikes. Historically, people have tended to go to the department store and, you know, buy what's available there. But there's more and more quality kids' bikes that are being made by, you know, people who are really passionate about cycling. And the biggest thing with kids' bikes is that, you know, people were realizing that they were really heavy. And, you know, kids are really light, and you give a kid a heavy bike and it just makes the experience not very fun. So, yeah, there's definitely been an arrival of a bunch of new brands to the market that are prioritizing lightweight and components that are kind of like, you know, to the quality that we as, you know, adults and passionate cyclists would accept in our gear, you know, and they're just scaled down for kids, which is really, really cool. I love looking at these bikes. I'm always like, oh my God, they're so cute. but yeah, there's a few brands that are doing a good job. Cleary Bikes out of Northern California is one of them. And yeah, they have like awesome parts, like little leather or like vegan leather seats. And, there's a brand called Pello, P-E-L-L-O, that's sort of same thing, made by a guy who's a dad and a cyclist and was just like, you know, I didn't see anything in the market that I wanted for my own kid. So he started making bikes. And there's a brand called Spawn, too. They're kind of more like mountain bike. But, yeah, they, you know, they spec awesome tires on their bikes. And, yeah, these are bikes that are going to last for years and can be passed down to a younger sibling or, you know, somebody else once your kid outgrows them. And they all come in a wide range of sizes for all ages, too.
So I'm speaking with Gloria Luce. She is one of the editors at Bicycling Magazine. She gets to test all kinds of cool new stuff. So what have you tested in the technology sector, like a computer or a trainer or maybe even an app?
Yeah, well, there's obviously a lot happening there right now. But I think for a gift, it's a really nice gift, I think, to give a cyclist is a bike computer if they don't have one, because I think that data can really empower us, and it can change the way that we ride, and it can help us ride smarter. And whether, you know, it's just knowing how fast you went up a segment or getting more into, you know, the hardcore data like heart rate and power, getting a computer is definitely the first step to that. And I think probably the computer that's impressed me the most in the last year and a half is the Wahoo Element. And what really sets the Element apart, I think, from everything else out there is just ease of use. Like I, ironically, am not a super like gadgety person. and I really appreciate an intuitive interface. And the Element is that. And I think what makes it so easy to use is that it pairs with your phone so that you actually use your phone to set up all your screens and your preferences. And it's just the phone is just such a better interface for setting stuff like that up. And Wahoo has done a great job of building the platform to make that possible. They have a couple different options now. probably the model I'd represent in terms of affordability and size is the Bolt. It's a little bit smaller than the original Element computer, but it's got all the features. It'll read heart rate, speed, you know, it's got full GPS, it'll read power, and it even has navigation too, so you can upload routes from Strava and go ride something that you've never ridden before, and it'll give you, you know, step-by-step directions.
That's really nice. So the last two things I want to talk about are stocking stuffers. So the, you know, kind of under $50 range, you got a couple of items that people would like to empty that stocking and see on the holiday morning.
Yeah, socks are awesome.
Socks are awesome.
Yeah, we know cyclists for some reason are obsessed with our socks. So that's something I feel like, you know, most people will be stoked to get is a pair of, like, stylish, fun socks. 10 Speed Hero makes some really fun ones. There's also a company called The Athletic. Both these companies just make, like, really cool designs that are really colorful, and there's a lot of different variation. 10 Speed Hero is kind of more the fun sort of cartoony stuff. Like, you can get, like, ice cream cones and little clouds on your socks. You know, Athletic is kind of more, like, kind of a little bit more sophisticated, but still, like, they do kind of more, like, almost natural-looking designs, if that makes any sense, like, stuff that looks like topographs and mountains and, yeah, I would be stoked to get a pair of socks from either of these brands. The other thing that's kind of fun that is something that my coworkers always stop and, like, look at in my office is these, like, custom stem caps by a little company called Bikelangelo. Bikelangelo. Angelo. And they make a ton of really fun stem caps. And they're like, they have stuff with like little cats on them and like little skulls and like funny messages. They've got like, I don't know, 40 or 50 different designs.
Wow. Wow.
That's a nice, like, you know, pretty inexpensive, fun stocking stuffer, a way that people can personalize their bike and, you know, just have something down on your handlebar that you can, like, look at and just smile, you know, like it's just kind of fun.
Well, the last question I have for you, and beside a bike, if you could only get one item for the holidays, regardless of price, what would it be?
Oh, gosh. Huh. You know, honestly, right now, I don't know if this is just because it's the thing that I'm, like, looking for right now.
Sure.
But I think that it's nice to give people a way to stay fit during the winter because, you know, that's a challenge we're all facing. Like, if the days are shorter, it's cold, we're going to need to ride inside sometimes if you don't want to just, like, get out in the spring and just be suffering because you lost all your fitness because you didn't ride all winter. So I think a trainer is a really nice gift. They're obviously a little bit more on the more expensive side, but, you know, if you know somebody who just doesn't need like a lot of bells and whistles and just wants, you know, something to put their bike on so they can get an hour in on a weeknight, you can get into a trainer for, you know, a couple $100. And they obviously can go all the way up to over $1,000 if you get something that has Bluetooth and can sync with stuff like Zwift. But yeah, if somebody gave me a trainer for a Christmas gift, I would be really stoked.
Well, Gloria, thanks so much for talking with us about holiday gifts. Gloria Liu, editor at Bicycling Magazine. And I hope you have a happy holiday.
Great. Thanks so much.
All
you
right.
Too, Diane.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Gloria Liu, join me from the offices of Bicycling Magazine in Emmaus, PA. Maybe you heard her talk about the gift you want this year, or perhaps that special item for a cyclist in your life. We're going to need to take another short break, and we'll come back to speak with Nick Ligon about his new book, Gravel Cycling, The Complete Guide to Gravel Racing and Adventure Bikepacking. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
We'd like to thank our podcast sponsor, Dodd Camera, for their support of The Outspoken Cyclist. There is a close relationship between cycling and photography, and we're proud to have this family-owned business as a partner in our show. If you're in the market for photo equipment, want to learn more about taking great pictures, or maybe you're ready to launch your own YouTube channel, visit DoddCamera.com and see what Dodd Camera can do for you.
Hey, we're back, and it's off to Longmont, Colorado to catch up with author, tech editor, and ex-pro bike mechanic Nick Ligon. Hi, Nick. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
Hey, it's my pleasure. So looks like you're in the right place at the right time with your new book, Gravel Cycling, The Complete Guide to Gravel Racing and Adventure Bikepacking. What do you think?
I think so. Yeah, I think the timing worked out really well, actually. I'm pretty darn happy.
You should be. It's a nice book. I like the format. You know, it's not, it's like a horizontal format, which is kind of nice. It's different from a lot of the books on the market right now. So that'll make it stand out a little bit, although the subject will too.
Absolutely. I mean, I wanted to make sure there were a lot of different kind of points of entry for the book based on different readers' experience levels or interests.
Cool. Well, let's talk a little bit about Nick's background. You've done a lot of things in the cycling world. How'd you first become interested in cycling? Were you born with the cycling gene, which is what we say about some people?
Yeah, I think I was, as I interpret what you mean by that. But I found cycling through the Boy Scouts. I was a Boy Scout in my youth, and the troop I was associated with decided to do the cycling merit badge one year, and I just kind of never turned back. So that we did an MS-150 ride, trained up for that, and then I found myself racing by the age of 13, so I've just never looked back.
Wow. And we won't ask how old you are. We don't really care. Let's talk about something else that a lot of people probably, yeah, right. It's like we are what we are. A lot of people are interested in this, and that is you were a pro tour mechanic for 7 years. I think a lot of folks
yes.
out there think it's a dream job. Is it?
That's a pretty loaded question.
I knew it was.
I think, and I say that because this, the idea of a dream job is somewhat a loaded concept. But I'm not going to beat around the bush. I had a great time. I saw the world. I went to the Olympics. I went to the Middle East. I lived in Europe. I lived in Australia. And I think for a young person, for a single person, I think it's a really, really great job. It's not something that I wanted to do forever. I joke that I've seen all the best parking lots all over the world because that's where you work at the end of the day.
Right.
But I also got to work all the grand tours and got to meet a lot of amazing, inspirational people. And no, I wouldn't trade that experience for anything.
Yeah, no, of course not. Of course not. And in fact, you work for a couple of the really big name teams of the day.
I did. You know, I kind of had my breakthrough. I worked with Team CSC in 2006, and that was a pretty amazing year. I helped Ivan Basso win the Giro d'Italia that year as one of his mechanics. I worked with Team Radio Shack. I worked with Garmin. I worked with the U.S. Olympic team. So I felt really lucky to get the opportunities that I did.
Yeah, really, really. So what do you think was the most interesting part of being a pro tour mechanic?
I think the most satisfying thing about being a mechanic is knowing that you contributed to a victory. You know, victories in cycling are hard to come by. I mean, if you think about the average NBA basketball game or just basketball game, one of two teams is going to win. When you think about the average bike race, it could be 20 teams and only one person on one of those 20 teams is going to win. So the odds are against you in cycling like they are in very few sports. So as a mechanic, it's just really satisfying to know that you did your job well, that you ensure the safety of all your riders, and maybe your bike was that little bit better, it functioned that little bit better, and your riders got across the line first. So that was really cool. You know, in particular, I was there as Kristen Armstrong's mechanic in 2008 at the Beijing Olympics when she won a time trial, the gold medal in time trial. That was particularly satisfying as a standout. Helped win some world championships. So there were a lot of high points, but it was really fun.
And then it was time to come home.
Yeah, so I actually thought I had finished being a mechanic at the end of 2009. I did a year with Garmin, lived in Spain. And I said, okay, I'm finished. And I started a service-only bike shop in Boulder with another former professional mechanic named Damian Shanks. And we said, hey, it's time to do our own thing. It's time to kind of, instead of using Boulder, Colorado as basically our vacation home, because when we were home, we were on vacation. It's time to build some community and really involve ourselves. And so we did the service course, and that was really great. But then I got a call from Johan Brunil. And he asked me to come work with Radio Shack in 2010, and I did that. But in the end, yes, I came home. I came back to Boulder, where I'd lived for some time, and then eventually got a job as the tech editor at Bell News, and did that for several years, which was really, really cool. I finally got to use my journalism degree.
Yeah, isn't that interesting? I find that after, and it's been way more years than you, that I use so much more of my education now, you know, that I'm like so much older. I didn't use it when I was younger. So that is kind of cool to go back and be able to use that. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Nick
Legan.
Legan, like vegan. Yeah, I'm not a vegan. I guess I should be, maybe. Anyway, his new book. The Complete Guide to Gravel Racing and Adventure Bike Packing, and it is Gravel Cycling. So when the book came in from our friend Dave at Velo News, Dave Trendler, my husband grabbed it, and I'm like, wait, I still have to do the interview here. He goes, no, I want to read this one. So let's move on to the book and talk a little bit about not only the reason you wrote it, but, you know, I think about gravel riding as sort of like it's the original form of cycling, because many roads were unpaved, are still unpaved. Mm-hmm. And, you know, many of us started out as bike tourists as opposed to racers. So why do you think it's seeing such a revival right now, this idea of gravel?
Yeah, well, I couldn't agree with you more. It is the original form of cycling. Those are the original roads. The resurgence, though, to me, comes down to a few things. One, unfortunately, I don't think we're growing the pie in terms of number of cyclists. I think that we're seeing cyclists look for new challenges and new ways to experience the world from the saddle of a bicycle. And I think for a lot of them, whether they're a mountain biker or a road cyclist or a touring cyclist or a bike racer, gravel is something new, and they can access it from any of those experiences. The other thing I think that's occurring, and I don't think this is news to anyone, but drivers, there are more of them, and they're more distracted than ever. I have a smartphone. I love my smartphone. There's no way I'm giving up my smartphone. But when I'm in the car, I'm not using my smartphone. And I think that that is scary not only for experienced cyclists, but certainly for new riders. So gravel roads are typically quieter roads. People are driving, hopefully, more slowly. But they're also, beyond a safety measure, I think they're also the most beautiful roads. So there's a lot there. And I don't think I'm being melodramatic when I say that I think this gravel cycling is going to be the savior of cycling as a recreational endeavor.
What an interesting comment, because I don't disagree.
Yeah, I have nothing against road. I still ride pavement to get to my dirt roads. I still love mountain biking. But even if you just think about a new rider, the experience level or the skills associated and necessary for mountain biking are somewhat advanced, and the consequences can be painful. And certainly the consequences of riding in fear, that alone, even if you were never had a bad interaction with a car ever on roads, if you're riding in fear, that's negating the whole purpose of riding a bicycle, which is to de-stress, to unplug, to get some exercise, some recreation. The other thing to think about in terms of gravel is that a lot of places already have that infrastructure in place. They don't need to create a trail system, which is it's thankless work on a lot of people's part, and I thank them for doing that. But gravel, over a third of the roads in North America and in the United States are unpaved. And let's hope they stay that way.
Yeah, really. And anyway, asphalt's expensive. We all know that. So, you know, when I think of gravel, I also think of cyclocross. So we're looking at, even though they're different, but what is the, okay, let's talk about what the difference is between cyclocross and gravel racing. Let's just talk about the racing end, because there are gravel races, and you actually highlight 18 one-day gravel events in the book. So what is the big difference between gravel racing and cyclocross?
Well, before we dive into the bike specifics, I think it's useful to think about the big differences in what a cyclocross race is and what a gravel race is. Typically, a gravel race is anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour long. So it's a very intense effort. And while some of the courses get pretty aggressive and pretty fun and pretty mountain bikey, it's in controlled environments. The net elevation of a given cyclocross course is going to be minimal, even the ones with the biggest amount of climbing. And the idea with cyclocross is when you have steep climbs, you're encouraged to get off your bike and carry it.
Right.
So it's a very short, very intense effort. and where getting through a corner at maximum velocity is rewarded. Gravel cycling, on the other hand, typically, and I'm going to generalize because I have to, they tend to be longer. While there are, and I don't want to intimidate anyone out of trying them, but I would say 100 miles or so is fairly typical. There are certainly ones that are 20 miles, 60 miles, and then obviously 200 and beyond. But they tend to be longer. And the idea there is that comfort and stability take priority over getting through a corner at maximum velocity, right? And to that end, the bikes typically have longer wheelbases, lower bottom brackets to lower to the center of gravity, be more stable, and they typically have more tire clearance than a cyclocross bike. A cyclocross bike, the tires are limited by the UCI, if you're racing at that level, to 33 millimeters. Well, in gravel riding, 33 may be more than you would ever need for the dirt roads in your area. But if you're in an area that has really chunky gravel, let's say outside of Emporia, Kansas, the home of Dirty Kansas, many of the riders in that area are moving over to basically drop bar 29ers with a full 2-inch wide tire. So the differences can be actually pretty stark.
Wow. Interesting. Interesting. So I didn't think of gravel racing as being those kinds of distances, but now that you say it, I can see how that works. And certainly cyclocross is one of those, you know, it's one of those crazy, almost like a circus. I think of cyclocross as a circus on bikes sometimes.
Yeah. And it's a great time. Cyclocross is a great party. But in terms of duration, I think that's the most useful way to think about the difference is just the duration difference.
So I do want to know if you'll highlight one of the one-day gravel events and one of the long 8 multi-day bikepacking adventure routes that you sort of detail in the book. Can you pick one of each for us and just give us a short synopsis of them?
Absolutely. I mean, the reason I wrote the book, if I'm honest, is because I fell in love with gravel cycling at Dirty Kansas. Dirty Kansas is kind of the World Series of gravel racing. It's a 200-mile race outside of Emporia, Kansas, which is just southwest of Kansas City. They also have a 100-mile option, and then they have some fun rides that are even shorter in distance. But I became really interested in it when I was at VeloNews, went and did it, and I had the best experience of my life on a bicycle. And I've gone back since many times, both to race it myself and also to support my wife, who's raced it. And the reason I love it is, one, that the gravel is really challenging. There's nothing flat about that area, the Flint Hills of Kansas. So it's constantly climbing up and down, you know, death by a thousand cuts. The gravel itself is flint, as the name Flint Hills would indicate. So it's tough on your bicycle. It's tough on your body. It's tough more than anything else, though, mentally. But aside from all the challenges, you are also surrounded by the most supportive, most positive, most enthusiastic tribe of people that you could ever meet. So it was just an experience that honestly reinvigorated my love for cycling. So I will always have a soft spot for that event. And if anyone has any interest whatsoever in doing it, I would say pay attention. The lotteries to get in for next year is coming up soon. That's certainly my favorite gravel race.
What time of year is that race?
End of May or early June.
So you need to start now.
Yeah, it's a warm time of year. It's really humid there, and then it can also be really windy. I've been there years where big rains came through as well, big mud years. So it's certainly a challenge, and the whole point of these for a lot of people is to challenge their limits. You know, a tagline that the race promoters themselves use is "Find your limits" for Dirty Kansas.
Nice.
And I think that's really cool. I think all of us are looking for ways to challenge ourselves and see to test our mettle in a way.
And bikepacking? Let's talk about adventure bikepacking, because I think, you know, you think of bikepacking, you think of panniers and handlebar bags and maps and, you know, lights and, right. and maybe peri-breast-peri, even a brevet and that kind of thing. But
right. That's
not really what you're talking about here.
It's slightly different. So gravel, I think, serves as a gateway drug for a lot of people into bikepacking. Once you've tested yourself and you figured out how far you can go in a day, you might want to think about going a little farther afield. And the idea behind bike packing is that virtually any bike could be used for it. And unlike the racks and panniers that you mentioned, you're using soft luggage that straps onto your bike. So it loops under your saddle rails and onto your seat post. It attaches to the inside of your main triangle. There are rolls that can be strapped to your handlebars, top tube bags for carrying food and accessories, things like that. And the idea is that you're going lighter, so you're going to do away with some of the amenities you might have, certainly in car camping or maybe in long distance kind of road touring. And you're typically, while you can certainly bike pack on tarmac, a lot of people are then drawn to dirt roads or even single track routes. So it's fun. You just get that little bit outside of your normal circle. I would encourage anyone to try it. And I think the best way to do it is to try just some overnighters from your house, ride out to that state park, have your overnighter and head home. And I outline ways to do that in the book. In terms of a preferred route, again, I'm going to shoot for the moon here. And it's in the book. It's the Great Divide Mountain Bike Route. It's 2,700 miles. It's actually about to be extended, over 3,000. But as it sits now, it's from Banff, Alberta, Canada, down to Antelope Wells, New Mexico, kind of running along the spine of the United States and parts of Canada. While it's called the Great Divide Mountain Bike Route, I think that that's a little bit of a misnomer. I think it's the best term they had at the time when Mike McCoy and his crew created the route 20 years ago. Actually, next year is the 20th anniversary of the route. But it is, it's phenomenal. I've been on a lot of different parts of the route, and it is thoroughly challenging, but also overwhelmingly beautiful.
Well, everything is detailed in the book. And so I wanted to ask you one more question before I ask you the questions I ask everybody who comes on the show. And I noticed that your dog has a really interesting name, so I'm going to ask you about that in a minute. But but I wanted to know what you think is the best product offering. Did you go to Interbike this year?
I did.
Is the best product offering that you saw for gravel? I mean, if something were to enhance your gravel experience. Now, I know a lot of good tires are coming out now, really good tires. Most of these bikes are really kind of, when I say heavy duty, it's not that they're heavy. It's that, they hold up under this kind of abuse, if you want to call it that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the bikes are definitely increasingly purpose-built. And whether they're calling that an all-road bike or a gravel bike, that's up to each manufacturer's marketing department. In terms of a single product, I didn't see a ton of new gravel products at Interbike this year. I saw a lot of it, but nothing that was overwhelmingly groundbreaking. The one thing that I'll say has been helpful for me this year is I got a digital tire pressure gauge from SKS. And just as the tires are exceedingly important in terms of where you ride and how you ride and for your body weight, the tire pressure that you put in it is also really, really important. So I think that's a great tool for quantifying and kind of making your approach more systematic to applying the tire pressure. So maybe that'll get the nod right now.
Well, you also just gave people an idea for a holiday gift. How cool is that?
There you go. You're welcome.
Besides the book. So I'll ask you my questions, then we're going to find out how we can get a copy of the book. What's your favorite food?
Oh, probably sushi.
Ooh, good answer. I like that one. What kind of music do you listen to?
All of it.
Okay. That's general. And then the last one is, all right, how did you end up? I know you have pets. Usually I say, do you have any pets? But we know you have a dog. What kind of dog is he? Is he just a dog?
She was a rescue. I got her from the local Humane Society.
Awesome.
She's a little 35-pound blue heeler, kind of Catahoula herding dog mix.
And you call her Coriander. And how did we come up with the name Coriander?
The shelter was calling her Pepper because she's kind of speckled. And I thought Pepper was a silly name for a dog.
So Coriander, of course, is not.
Yeah. Right. Well, all tongue in cheek.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Nick, this has been great. Thanks so much for talking with me. The name of the book, again, is Gravel Cycling, the Complete Guide to Gravel Racing and Adventure Bike Packing. And tell our listeners how they can get a copy.
Well, you can get it a lot of different places. If I got to choose, I would say please go to my personal blog, rambler.com. That's RAMBLEUR.com. And you can get a signed copy there or an unsigned copy. It is the only place to get signed copies, though.
Well, if that's the case, then that's the link we'll put up on our Facebook page. And thanks so much for talking with me. I hope you have a great holiday season. Don't eat too much Thanksgiving stuff. And maybe we'll talk again.
Love to. Thanks
All right.
so much. Diane.
Thanks, Nick. Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Nick Ligon joined me from his home in Longmont, Colorado. If you are interested, you can order a signed copy of his book, Gravel Cycling, at his website, Rambler, RAMBLEUR.com. That's our show for this week. My thanks to Jim Sonhalter, Gloria Liu, and Nick Ligon for taking time to chat with me. Next week is Thanksgiving here in the States. I hope everyone has a great holiday. We will be back with a brand new show next Saturday and another of our gift ideas. In the meantime, thanks for listening. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.